Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. We're calling on your help to make your listening experience the best imaginable. All you need to do is take a short survey. Visit acast.com/survey. That's acast.com/survey. Your opinion matters.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 20th of August. Our main stories: Syrian rebels appear to have lost one of their key strongholds in the north of the country. Russia dismisses international concerns about a recent nuclear accident, saying it's nobody else's business. And children make you happier once they've left home. Also in this podcast:
oh my God, we're lucky to be alive right now.
We hear from the kayaker who had a lucky escape when a glacier collapsed right next to him in Alaska. For the past 4 months, Syrian government forces backed by Russia have been advancing against rebels in their last major stronghold of Idlib province. The fiercest fighting in recent days has been around the town of Khan Sheikhoun, which has been held by opposition fighters for 5 years. On Monday, pro-government forces attacked a Turkish military convoy, which Syrian state media said was being sent to help the rebels in Khan Sheikhoun. Martin Patience in Beirut told me more about the town.
Well, it's a key strategic town. It runs on the main highway running from the capital, Damascus, to Aleppo. That is one of the reasons that the Syrian government appears want to take it in order to free up that road. But second of all, it's on the southern part of Idlib province. Now, Idlib is the last major opposition stronghold, and the Syrian government has vowed to retake every inch of its territory. And over the past 4 months after a ceasefire crumbled, we've seen major aerial campaign, airstrikes carried out for several months. But in the last couple of weeks, we've seen boots on the ground, and pro-government forces, according to what we're hearing, are on the fringes of Khan Sheikhoun, and rebels on the ground there, they have told us that they have left that town.
Does this mean the rebels are on the run in Idlib?
No, it means they're on the run in that part of Idlib. The reality is the rebels don't have anywhere else to go, so presumably they will push further into Idlib. And that's what international aid agencies are so concerned about, that as regime forces continue to advance, you're probably going to see increased resistance from the rebels. And that means that many civilians may end up getting killed. There's 3 million people living in Idlib province. In effect, it's been used as the dumping ground for rebels and civilians who will not reconcile with the Syrian government. And aid agencies are warning that if the Syrian government, backed up by Russia and Iran, continues this campaign, then it risks a humanitarian catastrophe.
Yeah, Turkey fears refugees heading over its border. Any more news on that attack on the Turkish convoy yesterday?
Well, I think that was really significant because Turkey backs some of the rebels in Idlib, and this is where it gets all very complicated. You have the Syrian government backed by Russia and Iran. You have the opposition rebels, some of which are hardline Islamists, jihadists. Some of them are backed by Turkey, and the danger always is in Syria, with so many foreign forces operating, that potentially there could be a direct confrontation perhaps between Syria and Turkey. For now, there was the convoy was targeted, but that seems to be yesterday's news. I think everybody for the moment is focusing on the fall of this strategic town.
Martin Patience. And after I spoke to Martin, Turkey did respond to that airstrike, with the foreign minister warning the Syrians not to play with fire. As we have previously said, we will do whatever is necessary to ensure the security of our soldiers and observation posts. That was the foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu. One of Turkey's concerns in Syria is the huge numbers of refugees crossing the border, around 3.5 million since the war in Syria began. However, Turkey has now been accused of sending refugees back to the war zone, as our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Istanbul.
It's Friday prayer here in Fatih, an area of Istanbul that's become a hub for Syrians fleeing the war. Around me, virtually all the mosque-goers are Syrians. Restaurants and shops are also owned and staffed by them. 3.6 million have come to Turkey, hundreds of thousands living in Istanbul. But as Turkey's economy slumps, Turks' patience with Syrians is wearing thin. The government has been rounding up Syrians in Istanbul, officially returning them to other cities. But we've been told many of them have been forced to go back to Syria, an active war zone, in breach of international law. In a cramped Istanbul flat, a Syrian father plays with the children he thought he'd never see again. Last month, he was deported to Idlib, where fighting is escalating. After staying for 10 days in Syria, he paid a smuggler $600 to get back to Istanbul to join his family. Now he lives in the shadows, we won't give his name, and he tells of being made to sign a voluntary return document to Syria, which he couldn't read.
The police gave us a paper which we had to sign and stamp with our fingerprint, but they covered it with their hands and didn't tell us what we were signing. On the bus to the border, police beat up one person.
You fled Syria to escape to Turkey. How do you feel now about the country that you say pushed you back to Syria?
When I crossed into Syria and saw the Turkish flag behind me, I hated it because this is a racist nation and government. I saw that during my 12 days in prison. They have no respect for foreigners.
Among the Syrians of Istanbul, fear is spreading. Noor has worked in the kitchen of a Syrian restaurant for 3 years, chopping up salads and hot chicken. Now he barely leaves the place. In this cupboard underneath the stairs of the restaurant, there's a single mattress where Noor sleeps every night. He lays it on the ground. He's laying it now on the ground. It's a tatty old single mattress, and this is where he now sleeps.
There is so much pressure and harassment towards us. We are afraid. We are not asking for aid. We don't want anything from the Turkish government. Just to let us work and live here.
Hostility from Turks is growing, some attacking Syrian shops last month. Polls show since 2016, empathy for Syrians here has dropped from 70 to 40%. The government says it's relocating Syrians not registered in Istanbul or allowing them back to parts of Syria under the control of the Turkish army. We've never treated migrants who we catch as terrorists or criminals, said the Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu recently, calling them helpless people and refuting claims of forced deportation, though they keep on coming.
Mark Lowen, reporting from Istanbul. An explosion 12 days ago at an Arctic Russian missile testing facility 1,200 kilometres north of Moscow was so powerful that radiation levels in the area were 16 times higher than normal. Days later, the two closest nuclear monitoring sites unexpectedly went offline. Another two followed, sparking speculation they were being tampered with. It's all deeply worrying for the international nuclear watchdog that tracks global radiation levels. But Russia has said the explosion, which killed at least five people, has nothing to do with the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. Our diplomatic and defence correspondent Jonathan Marcus is following the story.
What we think happened is that a new weapon system that the Russians are developing, which is essentially a very long-range missile that is powered by a small nuclear reactor, the engine of that missile seems to have exploded. So in effect, you've had a small nuclear blast. It's like a very small nuclear reactor blowing up. And that is what has led to the seismic and the radionuclei data. But of course, this network of sensors, which was set up to monitor the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, four of those sites have been turned off, apparently, by the Russians. They say there are communications and network issues. The suggestion amongst most Western analysts is that this isn't necessarily an attempt to hide the level of contamination which may be relatively small, we just don't know. It's probably much more an attempt to hide data that might give clues as to the design, size and so on of the particular small reactor that was powering this test missile.
And is there anywhere else that this information can be got from?
Well, a certain amount of information can be got from the network as a whole. Indeed, that is one of the reasons why there was an alert to this particular incident. I think it's a worrying development for a number of reasons, some immediate, some further down the line. I mean, one clearly is that the Russians appear to be developing this weapon, which, if you think about it logically, I mean, the Americans thought about something like this in the 1960s and abandoned it. You're essentially having a small flying nuclear reactor that can travel vast distances, driving this missile. It's going to fly over friendly countries. It's going to fly over other places. Is that really a good idea? Probably not. Secondly, it shows a pattern of behaviour on the part of Russia, a level of secrecy, a level of lack of transparency, which harks back perhaps to Soviet days. One thinks of the way the catastrophe around Chernobyl was originally talked about by the then Soviet authorities. And thirdly, there are other ramifications too, because the fact that they appear to have turned off some of these monitors to suit themselves raises a fundamental question in some people's minds about the nuclear test ban treaty, the comprehensive test ban treaty, which clearly the United States has signed. Therefore, it gets some of the data, but the Senate has never ratified it. And there are opponents of the treaty in the United States who will seize on the fact that the Russians have simply denied access to the data and will say, probably, you know, it just shows you it's not a great treaty after all, because the data streams can effectively be tampered with. And that coming at a moment where there is a growing strategic arms race between the United States and Russia again, where many existing arms control treaties are being abandoned or falling by the wayside, that just adds yet another level to the growing pattern of distrust.
Jonathan Marcus. A new study suggests that having children makes you happier, but only when they've moved out. The findings suggest it's only later in life that children become a source of enjoyment rather than stress. Adam Porter has the details.
Most research which has looked at the differences between people with or without children suggests it's the childless who are happier. But these studies have tended to focus on parents whose children are still at home, where they're costing time, money and sleep. Now, a German study of 55,000 people aged over 50 has found that people with children have greater life satisfaction and fewer symptoms of depression, but only if their offspring have flown the nest. Researchers think children who've grown up and moved out provide social enrichment without the day-to-day stress of looking after them. And they may also give something back by providing care and financial support to their parents. A similar study in the US found that empty nest parents were 5-6% more likely to report being very happy than those with children still at home.
Adam Porter. And before we move on, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service. 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter is a series about biomimicry, ways in which humans are solving our problems by borrowing innovations from the animal kingdom. Search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you found this podcast. And still to come in the global news, we'll hear from a teenage Somali poet who's just been published on iTunes in the US. Two American kayakers are recovering after a close escape from an Alaskan iceberg. Andrew Hooper from Texas was on the water with a friend near the Spencer Glacier when a mass of ice collapsed in front of them. Realising he was in danger, Andrew dropped his camera and tried to paddle away as quickly as he could. Just in case you didn't hear that. Lucky to be alive, he says. Andrew is a relative novice kayaker. He's been telling the BBC about his ordeal.
My buddy and I, Josh Bastier, we were out kayaking near Spencer Glacier. There's about a mile and a half long lake. We were just out seeing the icebergs, and obviously we got a little bit too close and got a little bit more than we bargained for. We had heard some noises on one side of the glacier and went to the other side to go figure out what the noises were, and then came upon this particular scene. We knew it was breaking. There were little pieces of ice in the water. Neither one of us had any expectation of it happening to the extent that it did. The amount of that ice going into the water kind of created that double wave for us to ride out to get further away from the glacier. If we were any closer, it wouldn't have turned out so well. I would not do it again, that's for sure. It was beautiful, but obviously respect nature. And again, we didn't know the power of that. We were ignorant to that. And we admit that, and nor were we, you know, equipped to, whether actual physical equipment or mindset, equipped to be that close to the glacier in the first place.
Andrew Hooper on his lucky escape. As you may have heard in our reports from the Chinese region of Xinjiang earlier this year, around 1 million ethnic minority Uyghurs are detained in re-education camps there. Now, 3 young ethnic Uyghurs living in the US have publicly called on the Chinese government to release their parents from what they describe as concentration camps. Kamal Turk Yalkun is a 28-year-old who came to the US 5 years ago to study. His father has been sentenced to 15 years in prison in China. The BBC's Lawrence Pollard spoke to him.
Last time I talked to my dad was October 6th, 2016, on the day that he was taken away by the police. He called us on that day when the police came to take him. He said, "This is not a good time, I'm being taken away." And that was last time I talked to my father. After that, he just completely vanished from my life.
Do you know where he is? Do you know what sort of a state he's in? Do you have any information about him?
After his initial arrest, for more than a year, we don't know where he was. We don't know his condition. In 2018, we got the news that there was a short trial with government-appointed lawyer, and my father was sentenced to 15 years in prison. And we still don't have any other information about my father.
What would he have been arrested and charged for? You mentioned show trial, and there are, of course, many concerns about the justice system in China as well. But what was he picked up for? Was he a community figure? Was he well-known? Was he political?
Yes, my father was actually a very well-known scholar among Uyghur people. He was a literary critic and educator and outspoken writer. And the crime that Chinese government arrested my father for is he was part of a committee that was actually set up by the government itself to compile Uyghur literature textbooks for middle school and elementary school kids. And these textbooks, after they were compiled by my father and the other people in the committee, they went through very harsh censorships before they were initially circulated. And after their circulation, government just decided to completely cancel and abolish Uyghur language education, Uyghur literature textbooks. So they just said these textbooks have ideological problems that are harmful to the government and the kids. So these people are the culprits. My father's crime in that short trial is attempting subversion of the state power, which is a very commonly used crime that China used to label its political prisoners.
Now, this is interesting because a lot of the accusations against people in Xinjiang are based on religion. It seems that your father fell foul of a nationalistic thing of language and culture rather than specifically religion. But I suppose in a sense they're all bound together in some way, aren't they?
Yes, you are right. As long as you're an ethnic Uyghur, whether you try to preserve your culture, whether you try to preserve your language, or whether you are enthusiastic towards religion, no matter which part of the spectrum you fall in the eyes of government, you are a dangerous person.
But why not just send your father to one of the re-education camps? Jail seems a very strong action to take against somebody who, from what you say, was doing something on behalf of the government originally.
When my father was initially arrested, actually this whole concentration camp situation was not yet started.
So you've lost touch not only with your father, with your wider family, with all your friends. How do you get any information out of what's happening in Xinjiang? You refer to them as concentration camps. How do you know that they're concentration camps?
There are still people that are fortunate enough to escape into Europe and the United States and Turkey. There are some family friends among those people, and we got news from them about what happened to my father.
In terms of getting your father out and getting the Chinese government to do anything, the prospects must be pretty much zero, mustn't they? Sadly, realistically.
Realistically, yes.
We've referred throughout this conversation to your father. Sadly, let's be honest, he isn't going to be listening to this. But if he were, what would your message be to him?
I know my father is a very strong person. So my message is, Father, please keep being strong. Please keep believing in us that we could someday in the future, that we could help release you and we will get your freedom. So please keep strong.
Kamal Turk Yalkun talking to Lawrence Pollard. Hospital burns units across Uganda are reporting a rise in acid attacks. Globally, there are approximately 1,500 assaults of this kind a year, according to ActionAid. But it's a crime that often goes unreported for fear of reprisal. Most people who suffer acid attacks are women and girls. The BBC's David Wafula has been to meet two survivors in Uganda.
Hello. Hi, Flavia. We are finally here. How are you doing?
31-year-old Flavia Nampima greets me warmly on the doorstep of her family home, the same place where she was attacked on her way home from school alone one night 11 years ago.
So I turned on my left and the guy just flashed stuff in my face and took off. The first minutes I could not tell what it was. I just felt like liquid on me and it was warm, so I didn't know. But then a few minutes it started stinging. I could feel my skin like burning. Something was hurting me. So I started screaming and crying, jumping up and down.
After being hospitalized for 8 months, she came home. She says it took time to adapt.
It was baby steps, getting out of the house, being able to walk till here where it happened. I would feel my heart beating so fast. It felt like I was reliving everything.
Flavia could not identify the man who attacked her, but each day has been a step closer to healing. She says pursuing what she loves has helped.
And then, of course, other fun things I do, like dance. I dance, I do salsa. That also has played a big part in my life because it has helped with my self-esteem as a woman.
Acid attack survivors can face discrimination in Ugandan society, but organizations are attempting to raise awareness about the issue and give survivors like Namuyomba Jamida tools to recuperate and re-enter the workforce.
In the outskirts of Kampala, I've just arrived at Hamida's house. From where I'm standing, I can see a carpet that has some craft. She weaves baskets and she weaves mats just to make sure that she gets money to support her children.
After the attack, life was hard. I lost my job, so I decided to leave the village, came to the city where I met other acid attack survivors through an organization that works with them. They trained me to do these crafts, which I am doing now, and I am earning a living.
Jamida was also unable to identify her attacker, and with no witnesses, her case never went further than a police report. End Acid Violence Uganda has registered 350 survivors in Kampala alone, according to acid attack survivor and activist Rina Ntoroinwe, who says there should be stricter controls on purchasing acid.
Acid is cheap in Uganda, and acid can be accessed anywhere at any time. The law is weak. Accessing acid is like me going to a shop and buying bananas. If something can burn metal, why put it on someone's body?
In recent years, burns units in hospitals across the country have reported higher instances of acid attacks, with one of Kampala's main hospitals reportedly admitting an acid attack victim every 2 weeks. Police Deputy Commissioner Pauline Amae says addressing domestic violence within the country and passing legislation is imperative.
It's not uncommon to hear of a case of an acid attack, not just in Kampala, but even in some of the developed towns like Mbarara or probably Jinja. We have some of those cases. And it's very unfortunate that even when there are other avenues of resolving conflicts, people still choose to go violent and use acid. But according to the Speaker of Parliament and some of the parliamentarians, there is an attempt to draft stricter laws when it comes to access to acid, and we hope that the situation will improve when we have that.
Dr. Adan Abdullahi says that recovery from an acid attack is a slow process, but with the right medical and psychological treatment, survivors can lead full lives.
Hope is probably the most powerful word that we know. What do I mean by bringing near normalcy? It's the reconstructive surgery. That's one bit of it. A patient develops very bad scars, sort it out. Put skin graft. But the near normalcy is not only surgical, it's mental.
While Flavia and Jamida are on the road to recovery, both the attackers are still at large. And until stricter legislation is passed, victims like them will continue to live in fear.
David Wafula in Uganda. A new album of poetry has just been published on iTunes by an 18-year-old Somali refugee from Salt Lake City in the US. It's called The Walking Stereotype and is about her experiences as a young Somali in America, from wearing a hijab to her reaction to the Trump administration's travel ban on some Muslim countries to gun violence. Her name is Saida Dahir and she started writing at the age of 7. Lawrence Pollard spoke to her from Berkeley in California.
Many people don't know this, but Somalia is actually called the Nation of Poets. Everyone in my family has written poetry and they express themselves in that way. So when I was around 7 years old, I thought that I could sing, but I couldn't at all. So I wrote a bunch of songs and realized I couldn't hit a note. So I had to change these songs into poems, and that's what I did. And I continued that, and it wasn't until I was in 7th grade that I actually read the first poem that I ever wrote. And it was one of the poems on my album. It's called The Thing on My Head, which talked about the hijab. And really, I just used poetry as a way to escape and to vent and to really write about trauma.
Is this also the sort of thing that, you know, many immigrant families talk about, for example, the importance of their home cooking or their home language, things like this? It seems that it's something that you brought in your family from Somalia because you were born in a refugee camp in Kenya as well. This is a piece of Somalia that you've taken with you to the States.
Yes, it is. A lot of Somali people that I know nationwide and all over the world do and write poetry that is so incredible that it stems from being from the Nation of Poets.
And what about doing it in English? What's the difference, Somali and English poetry? Can you do a comparison? Do you have arguments in the family about which is better?
I wish I could write a poem in Somali. If I could, I would run with it. But I do not have that ability to do multilingual poetry. But one day, I desire to be at that point. But I always feel that Somali poetry is significantly better.
So what do you think is the influence on your English? Should I look at Shakespeare? Should I look at hip-hop? Should I look at Maya Angelou? I don't know. Where does your language come from?
I really think that my language did come from reading a bunch of intellectual Black writers like Maya Angelou and James Baldwin. But really, it comes down to rap music. Rap is poetry, so I always listen to rhymes and rhythm, and that's how I came to be. I never really related to William Shakespeare or Iliad and the Odyssey and all these other epics. I had to really find myself in the narrative of literature.
Right, so that's where your influences are. What do you end up writing about? Can you give us a sample of one of your favourites? Would you read something for us?
Yeah, so one of my favourite poems is called A Paper and a Pen. It has to do with the Muslim ban and how Somalia is one of the countries on that list. It was a letter to President Donald Trump. Dear Mr. President, in those 7 countries, children can't even go to school. And here we have the audacity to sit in class and drool. So many children wish for an education with no limitation, but they live in a nation where little boys learn about war way before they learn their ABCs, while their families are thirsty and dying of disease. And when those bombs hit, there's nowhere left to flee. Are you too blind to even see clearly?
Saida Dahir talking to Lawrence Pollard. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on it or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. That is what Cici or Chi Chi Chen did to complain about our report on the top 10 jokes from the Edinburgh Festival, which was in the podcast yesterday. Sorry if you didn't think it was funny, but we do like to include culture in our coverage, and the festival is one of the biggest such events in Britain. And we've passed on your praise to Jonathan Savage. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.